So welcome all. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings at the Ottawa PC User Group. If you want to join, I paste it into the chat where you can go to join up. It's only $20 a year. Or you can just go to our homepage and just click on the link at the top. I'm going to go ahead and mute all now. And everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so, please remute yourself after making a comment or question so we keep background noise to a minimum. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. You obviously didn't read my message to you because the first item on the agenda is yours.
Yes, thank you. Okay, well, last week we had a poll online. Thanks for everybody who participated in that. We were going to run the poll again this week to see how many people were interested in a social get-together, and we decided not to run the poll because we've already got enough interest that we're going to have the event anyways. So for those who are not aware, it was in the newsletter, and we had it last week, but if it's new to you, we'll be having a social get-together on Wednesday, November 26th, starting at 7 p.m. And the location is at the Big Rig in the Gloucester Center in the East End. It's the Gloucester Center is at Blair and Ogilvie. And I will paste into the chat that URL. Let me just do that quickly. And there we go. And just a pointer on it, if you are going off the 174, you go north on Blair, which is just east of the split. And benefits there, plenty of free parking. You can get to it from the – if you take the O train, the Blair station stops right at the Gloucester Center. So very handy for that. We will be making the arrangements only in that we are – basically, just we will be calling them up and telling them how many people. I've talked to them. They said there's no problem. As long as we let them know in advance how many people, there will be no problem. So the important thing for everybody here to do is that if you do plan to attend, send an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca by Wednesday, November 12th. And on the 13th, I will be calling the restaurant and letting them know how many seats to reserve for us. And I think that's it for that. Do we have any questions on that? I don't see anything in the chat. If anybody does have questions about it, let me know or just send in a question to the suggestion box.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. So next up, I have a follow-up on an item I mentioned last week, that Google is changing the rules for Android developers. And basically, in 2026, they're going to require that all apps have to be registered by verified developers in order to be installed on essentially Android phones. And however, at the same time, they say that developers will have the freedom to distribute apps for sideloading, which means you don't have to go to the Play Store. You can download it from a website or the developer or whatever, and then load it onto your computer, onto your phone or tablet, without going through the Play Store. And so the question is, are those two things in conflict? How can you require verified developers and shut down loading apps and yet allow sideloading? And well, it turns out, if you read more of the material that's online, sideloading will be available for apps, but only for apps that have been created by registered developers. So there are going to be some more limitations than we see these days. Go ahead.
I think that the apps themselves will have to be approved. In other words, basically signed by Google. So even though you distribute them on other platforms, they'll probably have to be signed by Google, which means that they've approved it through their protection program. So as well as the developers being registered, I think each app will also have to be registered.
Well, that's actually not clear, but I think you're probably correct, because if you look at the requirements here, to become a registered developer, you have to give up your name, address, email, and phone number. They want a DUNS number, which I looked up is a Dun & Bradstreet number, or however you get one of those things. and you have to, or somehow you have to verify your organization's website. It says you may need to upload official government ID, so that will be some kind of driver license or some such photo ID probably. And then here's what Tom's probably talking about, that you have to, for each package, you have to give them the name and the signing keys. And so I don't know what they do with that once they have it. However, the other kicker is that there's going to be a $25 fee in order to register. Now, there are some free accounts going to be given out, basically for education and hobbyists, and just to distribute apps on what they say a limited basis. So clearly this is for me, if I wanted to distribute my app, but it wouldn't do for somebody who's developed an app and is doing it independent of the Play Store, but is sending out, you know, hundreds or thousands of apps. I don't know. Somehow they're gonna add these controls onto the system. So it does affect people, developers. We actually at the OPCUG has a sideloaded app. We have this SiteFinder app. It's very complicated. You click on the icon and it basically loads the browser and goes to opcug.ca. It is very complicated, actually. There's tens of thousands of lines of code to develop that app, but that's another story which I mentioned several years ago. Anyway, the thing is, probably nobody uses this app except me, so I'm not going to be paying $25, so we can continue to sideload it. The requirements are going into effect in a few different countries, in Brazil, okay. I don't know how I worded that there, but it looks like Brazil, Indonesia, Singapore, and Thailand are scheduled for these requirements to be coming into force in September next year. And then after that, in the next year, they're going to be rolled out more widely. However, what they're saying is after 2026, if the developers haven't registered, then new apps won't be able to go on regular phones and tablets. So there's a ton of information, both official from Google and also from various sources. And here's just a few of them. The end of Android Freedom was one of them. New verification rules. But then don't panic, Google isn't banning sideloading. So there's a whole raft of discussion on this particular thing. However, it's, to me it's like Google is taking over the world of Android, just like Microsoft is taking over the world, or trying to take over the world of PCs with Windows. Google's moving in now and locking up Android even more than it ever used to be. And I always didn't like the fact that you buy a phone and you get an operating system, but it's only good for like 3 years or something, and then you throw the phone away and buy a new one. Planned obsolescence, kind of crazy. So the question is, with all this going on, is it time for a Linux phone? And don't laugh, I mean, there are such devices out there already. This phone is called the Pine phone. It's about $150, I think that's US. However, the reviews say that it's basically a development type operation, that it's not really ready for prime time. There's also another one called Librem, which is more like $800 US. But again, I see the same kind of reviews, that it's somewhat limited in its abilities at this point. However, it's kind of interesting and might be worth $150 to play with this thing and see how well it works.
Alan, I have a question about one of your previous slides. I'm sorry to interrupt. Is it convenient to go back a couple of slides?
Sure, I guess.
Right there. The last point, after September 2000, apps from developers who have not registered will be unavailable for new installation. will be unavailable for new installation. Does that mean that an existing app will disappear off an existing phone, or does it mean you simply can't load it onto a new phone?
It means you can't load it onto a new phone.
Yeah. So I'm not going to have like bus apps and stuff like that disappear.
No, I don't think things will disappear. It's just that if you want to install a new app, then you're going to have to get it from a registered developer.
Yeah, okay. Thanks very much.
Okay, so so this is the hardware. There are at least a couple of hardware phones available. The other possibility is to load a Linux distro, and this operation called Postmarket OS has Linux available for all kinds of phones, but again, limited in terms of which devices you can install it and how easy it is to install it. One of the problems with Android is that the bootloader is generally locked, and it is not a simple process to unlock the bootloader, believe me. I've done it twice now, and it's rather complicated. However, there is this possibility that software is coming along and maybe things will be better. Interestingly, just a few days ago, the Free Software Foundation, which is the outfit that was started by Richard Stallman, the free and open source software guy, the Software Foundation has announced a project to develop, essentially to develop a software that will allow any phone to run Linux. So they're going to try to reverse engineer all the proprietary software that's currently on Android phones, device drivers and whatever, system software, and try to develop a system that will run on any phone. Clearly, that is going to be a long-term proposition because the source is proprietary, just like Windows. So it's going to be an exercise like wine trying to create software that will actually do the job. Anyway, there you go. I think for most users, you just have to be aware that there are going to be maybe going to be some restrictions in future, but most others are probably just going to keep going and buying Android phones as we need to.
Before we leave the topic, Tom pasted in a link to a Wikipedia article on custom Android derivatives, and do you know if they'll be affected?
Custom Android derivatives? No, I don't think so, because if you can unlock the bootloader on your phone, you can install a custom ROM. I think that's what we're talking about.
Okay. And Natalie asked if it's new apps going forward, and I presume that is yes, that's the case.
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, or new installations of any existing apps would be affected.
Yeah, that's debatable. Don't know about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of news will still be coming on this, and so.
I can imagine, though, Chris, that older apps may get removed from the Play Store if the developer doesn't register.
Yeah, so exactly.
It may not be available.
Yeah, yeah. So more news to come on this, I'm sure. And as they roll it out to some other countries, I'm sure we'll hear some feedback on that. Okay, yes, we'll go on then.
Next up is you.
Yes, thanks. Okay, this is about UniGet UI. And I had this pointed out to me a little while ago for primarily for keeping apps up to date. And I found it to be quite interesting. So it's a package manager for Windows, and that's not a typo because it is actually it's a manager for package managers. So what is a package manager? Well, a package manager is a tool that you install on your computer, and it will automate installation, upgrading, and removing of software programs. And it connects to what's known as software repositories. So anybody who has software that they want to distribute, they could have it put into one of these repositories, and then it is available by using the package manager for that particular repository to let people install, upgrade, or remove those software packages. So it takes care of everything. So it can bundle in dependencies and all kinds of things like that, make sure that everything that's required in order to get that app to run will be handled by the package manager. So there are multiple repositories in UniGet UI. So it is a package manager manager. So it looks at multiple package managers, and it can handle all of the ones that are built in. So the main one by far is Winget. And this is a Windows package manager, and it's Microsoft's, but it's free and open source command line tool designed specifically for Windows. And there are a lot of Windows packages that are available, including most of the Microsoft Store apps, or most of the major ones, are available through the Winget repository. So there's over 9,000 programs that are available through Winget. There's also a Chocolaty repository, which is apparently a well-known repository for Windows packages. I had never heard of it. There's a Scoop repository, which is for a lot of portable apps and command line tools. And then there's a bunch of developer tools. So there's three here that they handle, pip, npm, and .NET tools, which are separate repositories basically for programmers is the real focus of those. So when you install it, you'll get a pop-up by the system tray that tells you when updates are available. And you can see here I had 19 packages could be updated. And this is quite common when you install something, when you install it the first time, that you will find you have an awful lot of programs that are out of date, which is a little bit scary. So you click on, you could just click on update all, but I like to know what's going to go on, so I click on the open Unigate UI. And then it opens up the list of all of the packages that are installed on your computer. And it will default to this where it comes into the software updates button on the left-hand side. It lists all of the installed programs that have updates available. It tells you the installed version currently on your computer and the version that is available as an update. And all you have to do is click on the update button, and it will go through one by one and install all those updates. And I found this to be the case on every computer that I've installed it on. There will be at least a dozen programs that updates are available. And I've already been using update managers that I was kind of surprised that there were so many on my computer that were not up to date. Now, occasionally with this, you'll get an installation failure. And it'll show up this way where it'll show app installer update, and that's the program that it was trying to update, and you get in red, and you get this notice that it couldn't be updated, and click here for more details. And if you click there for more details, it'll show you the command line that actually ran, trying to do the update in the background, and why it failed, and I can never understand why it failed. So going to that never helped me. But if you go to that update selection, and you go on the chevron, one of the options in there is interactive update. And I found that that actually will usually work for any failures, that it'll work. If it doesn't work, you can use the option to ignore the selected packages and just update it any other way that you would have normally. So I very rarely have run into that at least interactive update won't solve the problem for me. Now, you can also install new programs through here. So the top icon on the left-hand bar is the Discover Packages, and you can just type in what you want to install. So in this case, I typed in AC/DC, and it came back with the different packages that have AC/DC somewhere in the name. And you can see that there was AC/DC free is available from two repositories. You can either get it from the Microsoft Store or Winget. And I could actually download it also from the AC/DC website itself. So there are three sources that I could actually do it from. Now, I thought immediately, well, what's the difference? So I actually asked Perplexity, what is the difference between AC/DC installed from Winget, Microsoft Store, and the AC/DC website? And there are some minor differences. I think in most cases, if there are multiple sources for the program, it's fairly minor. It's not likely to really cause you any grief if you choose any one of the multiple places you can get it from. Now, if you have software that's already installed, you can go to that third down icon on the left-hand side, and it'll tell you everything that's installed on your computer. And it will show you when you have things that are installed. It tells you in the source, whether it's Winget in the Microsoft Store or any other repository that is handled by Winget or a Unigate UI. And then you can also see some are saying local PC. And I say here that they're not updated by a UniGet UI, but in actual fact, I have had some applications that were installed on local PCs, so it wasn't installed through a package manager, but the package manager sort of took it over and kept it up to date. So it's not exactly the case that anything that says local PC won't be updated by one of the package managers. So here I have, for example, VLC Media Player, and it says it's local PC. But if I go to the Discover Packages and I typed in VLC, I could actually get it available through two repositories, the Microsoft Store and WinGet. So what I did was I uninstalled and you can do the uninstallation right through the package manager here too. On the install packages, you'll see there's a button there that says uninstall. So I uninstalled VLC Media Player, and then I updated from the UniGet UI, installed it from the Microsoft Store repository, and that way either UniGet UI or the Microsoft Store can end up keeping that up to date from now on. So kind of nice. So in the settings, there are lots of options, and there are a couple that I do recommend that people take a look at. First one is administrator rights and other dangerous settings. And that's what they actually call it. And then there's an option there for ask for administrator privileges once for each batch of operations. And I do that because if I have 19 programs that are going to be updated and you have user account control pop up every time, it's a real pain in the butt. So if you do check that setting, I haven't found it to be perfect. Occasionally I do get an extra prompt for user account control, but for the most part, it'll reduce the number of times that you get pop-ups asking you if you want to actually allow this program to make changes from to your computer. Under package operation preferences, there's an option, try to kill the processes which refuse to close when requested to. When you're updating any app, if it's already running, then it obviously has to close that process before it can actually do the update. Occasionally you get a process that doesn't want to respond to that call to close, and if you do this one, it'll just try to kill the process unceremoniously, so you're more likely to have it that you're not going to run into failures in the middle of an installation just because the program was running when it was tried to do the update. This one I think is really important. Package update preferences, check for updates every, and the default is every 10 minutes. And I have found when I left it at that default that I might have three times a day that it would be popping up and saying, oh, this program can be updated. Oh, this program can be updated. I don't need things updated that frequently. Yeah, once a day might be more reasonable. Once a week, some people might be quite happy with, but 10 minutes is a little bit overly aggressive. Then there's another thing on package manager preferences. So you can enable or disable different repositories. And this, Alan found that he was getting prompted to update hundreds of Python scripts that he wasn't particularly worried about. So if you go in and you disable that last category of the developer type repositories, you won't get prompted for those. So I would suggest using leave WinGet for sure. And then if you want, Scoop and Chocolatey are probably reasonable additional repositories to deal with. But if you wanted to reduce it down to just WinGet, I think there'd be a lot of benefit to using UniGet UI, even with just that single repository. So is it a panacea? No, I don't think so. I think most update managers and things like that, they're not panaceas. So you're likely to have programs installed on your computer that are not going to get updated by UniGet UI. And for those, just use whatever process you currently use to keep your programs up to date, whether it's going into the program itself and going to help check for updates or help about check for updates or something like that. There's three update managers that I actually have installed on my computer, and they periodically do check, but I don't get many updates coming through them anymore. Glarisoft Software Update, Patch My PC, and Secdair Volun Detect. Or just going to the vendor's websites to check for updates. However you get your updates currently, if it's not updated by UniGet UI, then you have to fall back to something else. So UniGet UI is an update manager. It's not a vulnerability manager. It's not going to tell you that a particular update is going to fix vulnerabilities, which is what I actually really, really prefer. But the only free vulnerability manager I know of is currently out there now is Secdair Volun Detect. Some software actually does a very good job of keeping itself up to date. Browsers will keep themselves up to date pretty good. Now, I will usually get an update come through Uniget UI faster than I will get it through just the update process within the browser itself. Nevertheless, browsers do a pretty good job of that. And a lot of other programs will take care of updating themselves as well. Most of the repositories actually deal with free software, and the reason for that is that it's really just, you know, installing this program in the background. Well, if it's licensed software, you need a license key or something like that to actually activate it. So a lot of commercial vendors don't want to put their software into a repository where somebody will get something installed and then they don't know how to go ahead and pay for this or whatever they figure they have to actually do. However, there are some commercial softwares available in the repositories, and ACDC was one of the examples. There were lots of their commercial versions that were available through Uniget UI, and specifically Winget was the repository. So you'll find it a lot with freemium type software where they give you a free version and then they'll nag you to pay for an upgrade to a version that has more capability. And basically within that, the program itself knows that it's giving you that reduced functionality program, and so they will do the nagging within the program. So they're happy to have this in a repository. So Uniget UI, I think, it's an incomplete solution for sure for keeping your software up to date, but I think all of the update managers out there now are incomplete solutions, and I think Uniget UI is actually more complete than a lot of the other ones that are out there, and I think it really can help to keep your software up to date, and it is more complete than most other update managers, and I don't see any reason not to use it.
Serge Eric has a question about whether this package keeps track of installations as well as a dedicated uninstaller program like Revo and Installer.
It keeps track of it only in the sense that it knows all of the programs that are installed on your computer that were either done as local PC install, which just means you did it on its own, or if it was done through Winget, or was done through the Microsoft Store, or was done through one of the other repositories. So it will list all of the software that was installed on your computer through any of the repositories that it handles, and it does allow you to do uninstalls just using the regular uninstall program that the developer designed into it.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, moving on, I've got an item here on Merlin. We have actually talked about Merlin previously. It's essentially a bird identification program from Cornell University. And it's really good. It's available for Android and the iPhone. And basically what it is an electronic field guide. So rather than having a book, you have all the descriptions of various species. You have many photographs generally of any given species, male, female, young, that kind of stuff. And you have range maps, so if you see a particular bird, it should be able to find out whether it should be in this area or not. And one of the other things it has is songs. So unlike a book, you can actually click on a bird, pull up the songs, and then play the song or the call notes, whatever, and see if the bird that's singing is the one that you think it is. And if you want to identify birds, then it has a couple of different ways, well, several different ways to do that. One is an expert system, so it basically asks you some questions, and then it tries to identify the bird based on the answers. And you can take a photograph and then give it the photo, and it tries to match the photo. And the really neat one is that it uses a microphone on your phone and actually listens. And when it hears bird songs, it has a database of bird songs. It looks it up and it will tell you, oh, this is a cardinal singing, that's a American robin. And every time the bird sings, then the listing gets highlighted. So you can see which bird is singing or which bird Merlin thinks is singing at the time. And then if you're a real keen birder, you'll have a life list, a list of all the birds that you've seen in your life, and this can help you maintain that. So it turns out I was in France recently, and we're visiting a museum, and we come across this flock of birds on the ground here, and I only had a cell phone, so I didn't have my my 35 mil camera to take telephoto pictures of it, and I tried to use the telephoto on the phone. The phone has three different lenses, so I figured one of them was a telephoto. Wrong. It only has a digital zoom. And when you look at the picture, you can see it's basically fuzzy. However, it's pretty clear that this is a well-marked bird. It's got a brown cap, a brown back, and the real kicker is the black pointed tail with the white rump. And it's got a big bill, so it's a seed eater. And feeding on the ground like that reminds me of, say, white-throated sparrows here. So some kind of sparrow or a finch kind of bird. So we tried to look it up. And here's a picture, here's a page from the guide. So, for example, if we knew it was a goose, we could go to this page and start looking through all the different geese and figure out which one we had. And you notice down the right-hand side of the page there's some green images of birds. And this is saying, you know, what kind of size, what did this bird kind of look like? And so you could hit the bottom ones there, they're the kind of small birds, and see what comes up. And I couldn't find the one I was interested in. So I thought, well, let's try the expert system. So here's the system where we say, try to identify the bird step by step. And the first thing it wants to know is, well, where did you see the bird? And I'm actually in Nice in the south of France. So I tell it, I'm in Nice in Provence. And then next it says, well, when did you see the bird? Well, today's date at the time was October the 1st. And it wants to know how big it was. Was it a goose size or was it a robin size? Well, it was a kind of a sparrow type size down here, sparrow sized or smaller. And then the next one, what were the main colors? Well, you remember it was basically brown on top, white underneath, and it had the distinctive black tail with the white rump. So black, white, and brown were my choices here. Now, what was it doing? Was it a feeder? Was it swimming? Was it soaring like a hawk? No, this was a ground feeder. So I've given it those five, I answered the five questions, and it says, well, was this your bird? Was it a northern wheatear? Well, that's too big. It's not that one, and it doesn't have very much brown on it. Clearly, it's got a grey back, a grey head, and the white throat. But it's not a wheatear. I know wheatears. But if I carry on, it says, oh, how about this one? Well, now we've got a finchy bill, a seed-eating bill, and a brown cap, a brown back. We've got a black tail with a white rump, and a spiky tail. And a small long-tailed finch, chunky body, short-stout bill, whitish rump and black pointed tail. Now that's a pretty good description of this is my bird, and sure enough, here's my bird. But you notice that I'm in Nice, France, and the distribution for this bird is on the Indian subcontinent. It's an Indian silverbill. However, it's a cage bird, and sometimes these cage birds get loose and they eventually establish a breeding population. They call it a feral population, and that in this particular case, this can be widespread. So that probably very much is the bird I had. However, remember I got that photograph. It's a lousy photograph, but a very distinctive bird. So let's try photo ID, and it says, just go back again here. It says take a photo, or in my case, I've already got the photo, so I'm going to choose the photo. It tells me, well, zoom in until your bird fills the box. So let's do that. And it's not a very good picture, but again, we've got that nice tail and the brown back and the white front. So half a chance. And sure enough, it wants to know where were we and when. So again, Nice and October the 1st, and try to identify it. And bingo, it hammers right in and identifies the bird. So Merlin's a really neat application for all kinds of different reasons. If you're interested in identifying birds, it has packages for Canada, obviously, Eastern Canada, Western Canada, but it has packages worldwide. So if you're going on a trip, you can just switch packages and have the same kind of capabilities available to for you wherever you are. So a really neat application, and I highly recommend it if you have any interest in birds whatsoever.
Okay, we have just a couple of comments in the chat, just other people agreeing that Merlin is wonderful, and no questions.
Okay. So next up, we have Chris on cybersecurity.
Yeah, okay. Let me just paste this one into the chat. Okay, so I like reading cybersecurity reports, and most of the security companies put out annual reports on trends or things like that. And I came across this one from the National Cybersecurity Alliance called Oh Behave, and it was all about behaviors. And it's basically a survey, the results of a survey that they sent out May 2nd, May 27th to several countries, US, UK, Germany, Australia, India, Brazil, Mexico. Canada was not included. They had over 7,000 respondents, and the ages were all 18 plus with an average age of 45. And what I found really interesting about this report was just going through and looking at the charts they have throughout this long report. So just some of the key findings that I found sort of interesting. AI is still a concern. So 65% of the respondents believe that it's making it easier for criminals to impersonate other people. And 58% have no training on use of AI or how to deal with fake AI and things like that. Another one, cybercrime, hitting wallets harder than ever. I found this a little bit hard to believe. 44% reported experiencing cybercrime with either data or monetary loss. That seems really, really high to me, but who knows. And then an interesting thing, too, is the Gen Z, the youngins, are really the ones getting hit quite high. In terms of reporting losses from scams, we usually hear about the elderly getting scammed and things like that, but the youngins are falling for all these scams too, or maybe even more so than the seniors. Near and dear to my heart, security habits, ongoing weaknesses. So only 62% are creating unique passwords. You should have unique passwords for every service and site you use. 41% never use a password manager. 77% actually recognize multi-factor authentication, but only 41% of it use it regularly. And only 56% update the software frequently. I think that's a real problem. And only 47% consistently back up their data. So if they lose their data due to being hacked or whatever, they're going to be SOL. So that was it. Just an interesting report. I would highly recommend anybody who's interested, just take a look at the report. It's long, but if you just go and look at the charts, it's quite interesting.
One of the things I find interesting there, Chris, is that it suggests that 60% of the people do use a password manager. I find that an incredible statistic.
Well, I originally thought that too, but I think even just the when you click on Save My Password in a browser, that's a password manager.
Yes,
and
sure.
From statistics, you never subtract from 100 because there's always a category that they didn't answer. So there could have been 20% didn't answer the question. So you have to be careful.
And I had one on my iPhone today that showed up saying it was a password that had been hacked or something. And I changed the password a long time ago, and I'm pretty sure it was coming up saying that this other one, the older one that I changed like years ago, was the one that was hacked. Because there's no way it could have possibly done, a random character 26 letter password and hacked that.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
The other disappointing statistic there is that 50% only 50% update software. Not that 50% only back up important data.
Yeah, Yeah, that's really, really sad because, yeah, I mean, if you get hit with, and it's not only getting hit by a hacker, it's if you have a hard disk failure, you have a fire or theft or whatever.
That's probably the most important program you can have on the computer is backing it up.
Yeah.
What's the chance of a password manager being hacked?
Only if somebody gets your master password.
Yeah. For the most part, I mean, the security on them is quite good. The encryption is done well. I don't know any password manager that has been accused of doing poor encryption. So as long as your master password is good and long, you know, the likelihood of compromise is really low.
Like that debacle with LastPass.
Yeah, it was the only people who got hacked were the ones that had lousy master passwords.
Master passwords, yeah. And all they got really was just email addresses and names, and that was about it.
Yeah.
All the rest of it was a big, massive encrypted stuff that they're going to need quantum key encryption to be able to unlock any of that.
Okay, so if you are worried about hackers and viruses and fraud, following up on Chris's report there, there was this article in PC World. Nothing terribly sensational here, just kind of a gentle reminder of some of the things. Talked about surge parameter injection. That's where I can't believe that people can register websites with Google. They come up in searches as being sponsored searches, and then what they do is they put their own phone number in the result. So it's generally one of these support type things. Phone here for support, and you're not phoning Microsoft or whoever. You're phoning the hacker. You've got to be careful with that. He said the Defender enough, and he suggested, yeah, Windows Defender's just fine. So that's no problem. Where can I find an online virus scanner? So to do a double check on, let's say, Defender or whatever antivirus program you're using, and do a dedicated scan with a different application.
Or use the total virus scan, and it scans them all.
We were just talking about backing up and how can I protect myself against ransomware, and basically back up and ignore the ransomware and just recover from your backup. And anyway, if you're interested in, you know, reading about some of that stuff, you probably already know it. The link's on the first page there, and it's kind of an interesting read, I thought. Okay, next up, some more cybersecurity from Chris.
Yeah, so this was, again, from the National Cybersecurity Alliance, same ones who put out that long report. Best vacation and travel cybersecurity tips. Now, that's not my assessment of their best tips. That is their title of their article. But it actually is not bad. And they really split it into three sections, which I thought was an interesting way of looking at it. So what do you do to prepare for your trip? What you do when you're on your trip? And then what you do when you get home. And it's kind of an interesting way to wrap it into those three buckets of things. They have links to other resources, a lot of very good resources, the FCC in the States. They're also United States references, of course. The CISA, Consumer Reports, AARP, so forth. So they did have some really good links to other sources of information as well, and they actually have a toolkit you can download, which has basically the tip sheet, infographic, on-demand webinars. It's really designed around people who want to present this material to others, but it's just a not too large a zip file. You can download and see additional information. So I thought it was worth looking at if anybody wants to consider extra ways of securing your devices when you're traveling.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And next up is yours too, a YouTube video.
Next, me again. Yeah, this one was kind of cool. We've talked a number of times about Dave Plummer. retired systems programmer for Microsoft, and he has a number of channels. One of them is Dave's Garage. He has Dave's Attic, and I think there's one other channel he has as well. And so at Dave's Garage, he did this interview with Raymond Chen, who is a really long-term employee of Microsoft, and he is referred to affectionately, apparently from by others in the Microsoft community, as a legendary developer. And he's really respected for his efforts of bridging old and new generations of Windows software and so forth. And I thought it was kind of cool interview. And some of the highlights of it, which I thought were kind of interesting, you know, why is there no 64-bit pinball shipping with Windows? And you would think that that would have been a natural. And he explains as to why that never happened. Why registry files are called hives. Yes, it has to do with bees, but probably not in the way that you thought. When you're setting the time zone in Windows, you're presented with a map, and you can just select the time zone by clicking on it. And I always thought that this must be a really, really simple thing. Not at all, and it's mostly for geopolitical reasons that countries are saying, well, no, we're not there, and you're identifying something that is our land in a different time zone and things like that. It was really quite tricky. Taskbar buttons, so you can group them, or you can have each individual task have its own button. If you group them, you would think it's rather simple. If you have three Microsoft Word documents, you'll get one button, and if you hover your mouse over top of it, you get a pop-up above it with the three different windows. But you can have tasks that are not actually as related as you might think they are related. And so that was actually kind of interesting discussion on how hard it is to take care of some of these things that everybody thinks is real simple. Early testing of USB devices. This was back in the days of Windows 98, and they actually had the USB cart of death, and it had 128 devices on it going through hubs and everything like that, and they would wander through with developers, and they would offer to plug this into their computer and see if they could crash it. And, of course, in the early days, it was quite common to actually crash things, and that's why it was called the cart of death. Near and dear to my heart, origin and evolution of the power toys. There's an interesting discussion about how they came about in the original and how they've evolved over time. This one I knew was probably not very easy to do, backward compatibility, and this is something Microsoft has always bent over backwards to, pun intended, to have compatibility with previous versions of software and things like that. And sometimes it gets real, real difficult for them to make sure that as they move forward with Windows, that the old stuff still works properly. This one I wasn't even aware of the fact that it really changed, but it used to be that compressed files were displayed in blue in Windows File Explorer, and encrypted files were displayed in green. And that's no longer the case. And in this interview with Raymond Chen, he explains why that's the case. This goes way, way back to the early days of Microsoft developing the operating system for Microsoft for IBM's original PC, and they actually had to circumvent security violations in their Boca Raton facility in order to continue to enjoy coffee, good coffee, which, of course, people coming from the Pacific Northwest, they were used to drinking good coffee, not what the swill they were getting at IBM's facility in Florida. And then he wrapped it up with what keeps Raymond coming back to work after 35 years of working for Microsoft. And so it's an interesting interview. It's quite long. It's about an hour, I think, total length. But I think it's really interesting to listen to. And you can probably listen to it at 1.5 times speed in YouTube. And it's quite understandable and quite an interesting interview. So highly encourage people to take a listen.
And it's worth listening to, Chris, just for the story about the coffee pot.
Yeah, it's quite funny.
Okay, didn't see anything early on, but... Mm-hmm. So Elizabeth is saying that she watched Dave's explanation of the AWS outage. And she found that really interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was much more detailed and I guess maybe even trustworthy than a lot of the press that was out there about what actually happened. And, yeah, I thought Dave did a very, very good explanation. Fairly technical, but if you have a little bit of a technical background and you really want to know what went on, I think Dave's explanation was really very, very good.
Okay, well, we've worked a miracle, Chris. We're into the last 10. I think this is the first time for a long time we've actually had 10 minutes for questions. So if anybody has any questions or wants to talk about some of the talk further about some of the things we've discussed tonight, if you have interesting things to share with the group, now would be the time. So
put something in the chat.
Linda was raising her hand.
Yeah, I just have a comment because I know you have a lot on the agenda, but if there's time at an upcoming meeting, I would really like to see some of those travel tips, because if I go to the document, I might understand it, but Chris has a good way of explaining these things so that I do understand it. So I might not be, I don't think I'd be alone in the audience tonight, but I'd really like to hear some of those pre-travel, mid-travel, and post-travel tips if he's willing to do that.
I could, but in actual fact, the Cybersecurity Alliance, they actually dumb things down to a fairly understandable level for the masses. I think if you were to check it out, you probably would not have difficulty. Anything from the Cybersecurity Alliance is really meant for the average person on the street.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. But if you take a look at it, and if you think that there's some that require it, I'm happy to do it at a Q&A, because if you have a hard time understanding it, then for sure other people would as well. It's just that I think most of the stuff from Cybersecurity Alliance is pretty easy to understand.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
Yeah, thanks.
So Stuart made a comment here that the CBC story that smart beds were adversely affected by the Amazon power outage. And I there was an article in PC Magazine, I didn't read it, but it said something to the effect that people in these smart beds were being roasted. So it must have been a temperature control thing, and it went a bit haywire.
It certainly took out an awful lot of things. There's a lot of large organizations that are dependent on AWS.
Yeah, if you get devices and so on that are web dependent, then things outside your home can affect whether they work or not, or whether they start burning up.
Burning you up.
Yeah. I don't see anything else in the chat.
Okay, let's move on then, because I got a few wrap-up things. We'll take a couple of minutes, I guess. I haven't used this slide for a long time, but we really do need some input from people, and we're interested in anything that is computer-related. And I've got this long list of things here. And if you have questions about hardware, software, operating systems, whatever, if Chris and I can't answer them, we can certainly try and find somebody who can. So any question is always welcome. And various people have given shares on things that they've been interested in. And again, they've been really interesting. So I really encourage people, if you have a topic, a piece of hardware, a software program, a smartphone app that is indispensable or interesting, or you just like to tell people about, just think about doing one of these mini shares, 5 to 10 minutes or something, on this thing of interest.
I discovered one thing the other day I didn't know about. I don't know if you've ever used Notebook LM to do the it's a Google app, part of their collection, and you put in a PDF manual for your car or computer, phone, whatever, and it generates the AI with that as the database. So you can essentially ask a question, like if it was your car, you could ask it how you turn on, you know, this dial, that, whatever, and it comes up with the answer. But there's another function of it where you can actually put in audio files. So you can actually put in ebooks and audio books and all that sort of stuff, and then ask the thing a question, and it'll actually work out the answer from audio files.
Oh, there you go, Steve. Next week, we can reserve a spot for you next week there, Steve.
There's the presentation.
That sounds great.
I used Notebook LM. My doctor retired, so I put all the files and so on that she left about me into a Notebook LM, and then I asked a series of questions that basically summarized my whole medical history with her. So it can be, I don't know about the privacy of this, but I'm not worried about insurance. You can not just put in one file, but you can put in multiple files.
Yeah.
And it has enough medical knowledge to be able to interpret them as well. And I suppose other knowledge about cars for a car manual.
Well, I tried something else different as well. I asked it a question about something that didn't have anything to do with the manuals I put in. And the answer it came back said so.
Hey, guys, rather than discussing it, what we really need is somebody to do a share.
Exactly.
Let me carry on. Yeah, we talked about useful programs, YouTube channels, YouTube videos. We've had some of those tonight. If you have anything that's of interest to you, it probably of interest to somebody else. Computer basics, smartphone basics, Looney links, so just links to Canadian websites that are of interest to people. And we talked about operating systems and any operating system that we have. Now, there is an actual question in the chat here from Sheridan. They want to know, how do you create a zip file and how do you open it? How do you open it is pretty easy. If you're on Windows, just double-click on it and it will pop up. File Explorer will say extract all. To create a zip file, I'm not quite sure whether you can do that in Windows. I never do. I use a third-party app called 7-Zip. And basically, you just highlight the files that you want to include, right-click, and create an archive. And we can actually do a demo of that maybe next week. Anybody have any additions to that thought?
Yeah, Windows uses the zip file just like opening a folder in Explorer. You don't have to extract anything. You just click on the thing, and it goes to it just the same as it does any other folder.
Creating it
is different, though, right? Can you do that in Windows?
Yep. Yeah, you can right-click and do Compress To. Actually, I'm not sure of that extension, if that came from there or not, if that's native Windows. I have it on mine.
Yeah, it's a good way of keeping private folders as well. You can just create the zip file and put a password to it.
Yeah.
Okay, I notice here Chris has said he'll be able to do something next week. So we got two things next week, Notebook LM by somebody and Zipping by Chris. Good stuff. Okay, if you want to know the answer to the questions, and you can ask it in the members forum, you can ask it on Q&A, but if it's something that would be much better answered by people being able to see your screen and see what you're doing and help you, and then we have this one-on-one remote assistance program. So if you need any help that would use that kind of logging onto your system and seeing what was actually happening in real time, we have this one-on-one request email, oneonerequest@opcug.ca. It went and did the moving along all by itself again there. However, the one-on-one remote assistance program is only available to members. So if you're not a member, then go to our join and renew command, new page, and spend $20 and join the club. If you are a member, just ask the question and somebody will be happy to try and help you. He did it again.
I think it must be something that I'm doing, but I'm not sure. I was typing something into the chat, but
okay. All right. OPL presentations coming up. PC tips. Chris is doing that at Orleans. You want to restore old photographs. I think that's like a workshop, so bring your old photographs and Linda will help you at Cumberland on November the 1st.
No, don't bring all your old photographs. That's not how it works.
I thought it was a workshop.
No, it's not. It's a lecture. It's showing you how to edit them in Photoscape X. Don't bring your boxes in, please. I have no scanner.
And the third one we have here is artificial intelligence, fun and useful tips. And the library website says that that's full, but Chris always says that there are always no-shows, so I'm sure he'd say if you want to go see that, just show up and no doubt there's going to be room.
Yeah, usually the library, when they set a limit on the registration, but then they put a wait list, and for some reason Greenboro just didn't have a wait list, so you can't even get it on a wait list. But, just if you're interested in anything that is showing as full or wait listed, if it's wait listed, put your name on the wait list, but just show up anyways.
The library is amazing. However, you do need to log on to the URL here and register with the library for the presentation. Okay, I don't know if there's anything else in the chat, Chris. I haven't been...
No, nothing. We have a fairly lengthy one on somebody, user out there, who has a desktop PC. They subscribe to McAfee, and it's coming up for renewal, and it's expensive, and they just wondered about whether they really needed anything else. And several people pointed out they just use Windows Defender. I pointed out that I give a two-hour presentation on protecting your PC at various branches of the Ottawa Public Library. It is protecting your PC is much more than any virus. So I spend a fair amount of time talking about antivirus, but it also goes to firewalls. It goes to patch management. And so forth. So there's much, much more to protecting your PC properly than just antivirus.
Yeah, but I would echo the comments about antivirus. I've been using Defender for years and never had any issues. It works really well.
Yeah.
Okay. That takes us right to 8:32. Isn't that good? All right. So next week will be our next Q&A session. So if you have any questions or follow-ups to things we've talked about, and just send us a note to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and whoever's going to do that notebook LM presentation will reserve you a slot, and we'll reserve Chris a slot for his zip presentation. So we've got some things on the go already.
Yeah, and
if
I may
have to add to that, then let us know.
I may have a share as well, Alan. I'm just going to double-check something with Chris to make sure we haven't already shared it fairly recently.
Okay, perfect. All right, so I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. We had a fair mix of stuff, a lot of good discussion about things. And so I hope we'll see you all next week.
Hey.
And Ma, if you're still on the line, you had something, has anybody heard? Messenger, Facebook are now limiting the time posts are kept. Someone told him that there is a message that specifies posts will now only be kept for 40 days. I hadn't heard of that. Has anybody else heard of that?
No.
Deafening silence. So I think that is probably not accurate. I can't see that. I don't know about Messenger, but certainly Facebook. They wouldn't limit the time posts are kept to 40 days. I mean, there would be a lot of hue and cry about that. If it was actually happening.